Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return with part two of Michael Parenti's fine speech in Springfield, Illinois, of October 16, 2015. It's called Capitalism versus Reality. It's a fascinating and brilliant talk. Enjoy.
The capitalist state, and that's what we live under. We live under a government that works in a capitalist system. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is to maintain and advance capital accumulation. That is, the companies, the corporations have to keep making their money, and that process of them accumulating wealth has to be protected. And it's being protected very well. In the last 10 years, all the new wealth that has been produced, all of it went to the top 1%, 1 or 2%. And when I talk about capitalism and such, I'm talking about the giant corporations. I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses, because all I can say is I'm not talking about them. Lenin was right. He said 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. A cartel is like the oil cartel, which would be made up of Exxon and Mobil, and they collude together and they divvy out the market and they play with the prices and the like. Small business, like I call it, the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And you know what happens to squirrels would dance among elephants? Have you ever seen it? No, you haven't. But they tend to get smashed and squashed. I've been accused of being soft on small businesses, and that's true, I am. As individuals, capitalism does not usually bring out the best in us. We face too many ugly necessities created by the competitive dog-eat-dog system. Unfortunately, capitalism best rewards the worst part of us: ruthless, competitive, conniving, opportunistic, exploitative, acquisitive drives. Private enterprise, as it's sometimes called, gives little reward and often much punishment, or at least much handicap, to honesty, compassion, many forms of hard work, cooperative and collective effort, love of justice and fair play, and a concern for those most in need. There was a great labor union leader who later became a noted socialist leader, American, named Eugene Victor Debs from Indiana. And Debs remarked with bitter irony that to the extent that that life in an advanced capitalist state is made bearable or decent, barely decent, it's because of the humanizing effects of democratic struggle and labor struggle. And Debs started figuring all this out while he was in jail. He was leading the railroad strike and all that, and he got beaten up and thrown in jail. I've been beaten up by police and thrown in jail. And let me tell you, when you get slammed in the jail and slammed against the bars and thrown in there and they lock it up, you have time to think, you know. You really sort of sit there and you say, what is going on? What is this all about? Wait a minute. Where's the stars and stripes and all that stuff? Nobody's singing. And Debs was sitting there and he's saying, this is crazy. Why are the cops on the side of the big bosses? Why aren't the cops out there on the side of the workers? We are the people of society. We're the people who do all those jobs. And then he began to realize that the state is not neutral. That state is not neutral. If there's a disruption and this and that, the state comes out and they start serving the powers that be. But Debs was making this other point, which I thought was very interesting, that the more successful we are, we pull down certain, you know, increases and betterment in wages and this or that and this and that. We make life a little bearable, more bearable. We cut our 14-hour day to a 13-hour day. That's a little bit better, you know. Whatever, we try to make this society more human, we are legitimating it. And what we really should be doing is telling the people, look, this isn't for us at all. This is a society that's heartless and inhumane, and we're making it somewhat a little more humane. We create little patches of community and democratic distribution in which we try to live. Is capitalism not a successful economic system? It has success. It is the envy of the world, what we have in America. Well, it really isn't. It depends on your position in the social order. Let's start with capitalist leaders. Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman, Democratic Party, Speaker of the House, in 2008, at the end of George W. Bush's term, she says, "Bush is a complete failure on every policy area." I would argue Bush was a smashing success in almost every policy area. Bush himself didn't hold back in his personal praise. He said, and I think he was right, absolutely right, he said he accomplished everything he could do within the strictures of the presidential office, except two things. He failed to undo Social Security. That means pensions, dependency, and disability. That's what Social Security covers. If something bad happens to you, you will not be left to just lie in the street. You do get some support. It's a socialist program. That's socialism at work. And they are dedicated, the conservatives are dedicated to eliminating it every chance they can get, or nibble away at it, or break it down, minimize it. Bush also pointed out that he brought in, well, no, he doesn't point it out. I'm pointing it out, what Bush did. I'm sorry. Bush had provided massive increases in the military budget, a military budget that went from $250 billion to something like $526 billion. Today, under Obama, it's closer to $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. Some of that money comes from the Energy Department. Some of it comes from other things. Some of it comes from these other wars that are then slapped onto this budget as an extra budget. Massive shifts in tax burden to the working class and middle classes. Cutbacks and defunding and deregulation of human services, including public education and environmental protections. Massive debt, which helps to defund government. Kill these programs, not because they don't work, but because they do. That's why they want to get rid of Social Security, not because it doesn't work, but because it does. It's been about the best check on poverty, elderly poverty, that we've had. Capitalism is less successful in the more prosperous countries. That is, a country that is prosperous, like Finland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden. These are the social democracies. After World War II, they faced the Red Army along the Elbe River. They faced, all of Eastern Europe was now communist. All these communist countries were now providing Social Security, old age pensions, supports, guaranteed right to a job to every worker, free medical care to every worker. This was going on in the communist countries. Subsidized rent and housing. No worker could spend more than, I think it was 15% of his salary on rent. So you were guaranteed, you didn't have to put all your money on your housing. These kind of things were very embarrassing. And after World War II, you had a very strong social democratic parties, including some communists, voting and bringing in governments that did these generous human services for all, more equitable tax system, consumer and worker protections, excellent utility and transportation services, and then all the things I just mentioned about the other social democracies. But social democracies are recent. And they're never really secure. Look what's happened in the United Kingdom. It's rolling back now since Tony Blair. They've been undermining it and cutting it back, and the Brits are paying more and more and getting less and less for it. And there are cutbacks all through Western Europe because there's no more Eastern Europe. There's no more communism. The Red Army's gone. The big communist parties in France and Italy are pretty much gone. So the guys at the top no longer have to make frightened concessions to the mass of the people. In contrast to the social democracies of Western Europe, I mean, they're still pretty good. They're better than what we've got. I mean, if you were ill, you're much luckier to be ill in Finland than in the United States. Capitalism is a more complete success in countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia, El Salvador, places like that. That's where, let's take Indonesia. And by successful, I mean more successful in serving that 1% at the very top. They don't have to kick back for all these regulations and all these human services and such. In Indonesia, there's no customer service or warranties on commodities. Drinking water is privatized and unclean. You have to buy drinking water and you got to hope it's clean. No public health services, no environmental protections, chaotic auto traffic, regular bus plunges, buses going off because roads are so poorly graded and unfixed, rampant crime, terrible poverty. But the rich, the rich in Indonesia, they live so well. They live in such lush luxury. They have small armies of servants who serve them. And the servants are de facto slaves. And if the servant doesn't want to serve and wants a day off or wants that, he or she can be kicked out. And there'll be five other people waiting at the gate to come in and serve. And so that's the kind of world that the capitalists want, a world of billionaires who can call their shots and the rest of us lining up with bowed head. Capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but to prosperity. Not true. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. And that's what I was saying about Indonesia and the like. The poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less. And the more surplus value I, the boss, can extract from you. Free enterprise and competition are widely celebrated as part of the dynamic and abundance of capitalism. In fact, the corporate enterprise system almost always is in a state of crisis. Even in the USA, abnormality is normality. Recessions, 1780s, terrible recessions, terrible fights about rent, land rents and taxes and such. It led to Shays' Rebellion, and Shays' Rebellion led to the Constitutional Convention. They hurried together to whip together a stronger government to stop this kind of thing. 1805 panic, 1820s recessions, 1850 market crashes, 1873 a whole decade of depression. Another whole decade, 1890s, Teddy Roosevelt, 1896, saying, this country needs a war, any war. And he got it in 1898, which was what? The Spanish-American War. 1910, 1920s. The 1920s were a recession time. I never learned that. We always learned the 1920s were what? The jazz age, right? The roaring 20s, they were called. Charleston. With very little inducement from you, I can do the Charleston, right? But I won't. This went on through the whole 1920s. You know where the recession was in the 1920s? It was mostly in rural areas, which is probably why it could go undetected. But in the rural areas, it was very hard on people, both black and white. Then at the end of that decade, in October 1929, came the great crash of the stock market and the depression came. That depression lasted from 1929 to 1941. It ended in 41-42 because the U.S. was now in a major global war against Japan and Germany. 1941, this is where you got to take a look more closely, because this explains the great American prosperity, and it did come around that time. I remember my uncle Nick and my dad and my uncle Joe all talking and moaning about how the war is going to be over fairly soon. And we're going to be hit with a terrible depression again. I said, why? I always used to hear about this thing called the depression. You're surprised to know I was even alive then. I look so young, don't I? You thought I was like, like 35 or 40, I know. Okay, yeah, right. They understood that 9 million young American men and some tens of thousands of women are going to come back out of uniform and come back into the economy. There's going to be no jobs. Where are all the jobs going to be? See, the depression ended in 41 because the U.S. was ready to really spend. They spent deficit spending. They spent enormous amounts of money to do in war what they could would never do in peace, which was to build all these planes and tanks and whatever else. But when the war was over, these 9 million of these people who came back entered the GI Bill of Rights, GI Bill. The GI Bill was a tremendous program. It brought it to every veteran from the war could go back to school, and he would get a full stipend and a full payment of his tuition fees also, a scholarship. Or others could start small businesses, and others could do all sorts of other kinds of things. It turned out to be one of the most economically terrific things. GI veterans who hadn't finished high school were now becoming accountants who are going on into other professions. It actually enriched the whole economy terrifically. Another thing that happened was all during the war, people like my Uncle Nick, who used to make $50 a week as a garage mechanic, he quit being that during the war, and he went to work in a war factory, and making planes and this and that. So you had people now doing all this kind of work, and coming away with lots of money. The trouble is they had nothing to buy. I remember that too during the war. Everything was rationed. So you had all this money now, but you couldn't buy. The factories were no longer making electric toasters or refrigerators or cars or anything like that, or houses. The factories were making planes and tanks, and you couldn't buy a tank, and you didn't have much use for a tank anywhere. So you had this immense backlog of buying power, and that's really one of the problems of recessions is, of course, you haven't paid your workers enough money to buy back the goods and services that they're producing, and that's why you have a recession. So all of that was changing, the GI Bill and then this. And from 1947 to, I would say, 1979, 1981, during the last 2 years of Carter, where he started selling out, and the introduction of Ronald Reagan coming in, up until that time, that's the immense prosperity you got, building of suburbia, building of highways, the kind we... Everything you see and take for granted now, freeways and highways, all those things, they didn't exist back when I was graduating from school. When we heard that the Pulaski Highway in Jersey, did you hear about it? You can go 60 miles an hour. Wow, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, a mile a minute. Well, that's only 60 miles an hour. What's so fast about that? We learned later on as more and more cars came out and this and that. So there was this kind of backlog of consumer hunger, a consumer hunger that's backed by money, by ability to buy for it. That became the basis of the great prosperity, a prosperity which is now eluding us, a prosperity which is declining and declining. You hear reports about 20,000 more new jobs, people, but they don't tell you about the quality of the jobs, the paying of the jobs, the durability of it. As part of the myth of prosperity, the Horatio Alger myth, as you know it, the view that every generation is more prosperous than the previous one, it just isn't so. In the last 20 years, all the new wealth created went to the top 2 or 3% in the last 20 years. The rest of us have worked harder and stayed much in the same place. And if you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. Our national debt is greater and greater. It's up to, what, $17 trillion now? We, the taxpayers, owe that. The national debt belongs to us. Karl Marx made that point in Kapital, Volume 1, where he said, of all the things in society, the one thing that belongs to the people is the national debt. They own it. They'll be taxed. They have to pay it. And they pay it to those who own all those U.S. bonds, those national bonds and such, which are the rich. This recession that we've been living in now, the 2008-09 one, is still going on 2015. These recessions, it's like all recessions, it has certain advantages, not for us, but for the 1%, the people at the very top. It wipes out weaker competitors. It allows mergers at more affordable costs, concentrations. Marx called that One capitalist, the phrase was, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. Back in 1910, there must have been 20 or 30 auto factories, auto businesses arising. About 13 of them provided electric cars, believe it or not. The electric cars got wiped out, though, and the others came in. By the great prosperity, we're talking now no longer about businesses, we're talking about giant corporations. You had only three auto companies, right? Ford, Chrysler, who was the third one? General Motors, the biggest, I forgot it. Yeah, General Motors, right, thank you. And that's the way it is with the oil companies. That's the way it was with the meat packing companies. There must have been about 200 meat packing companies. To play safe, I'll say by World War I or by 1920, that had broken down to Armour and Swift and one or two others, about four or five of them. I'm thinking of the book, The Triumph of Conservatism. And it was about that turn of the century where the cartels and these few big companies took over. And it happens all the time. I think it happened with computers, didn't it? I mean, there were all sorts of little companies starting up, people's garages and this and that, and all. And then it gets back down to what, three or four companies, giant companies with billions of dollars. That doesn't mean that these big companies don't take money from the government. They do. They don't want you to take money from the government. They don't want you to get food stamps. They don't want you to get rent subsidies. But they take money. They take billions every year. They take over land, for instance. What the Pentagon does with McDonnell Douglas, right? Well, they'll give him the land. They'll give him the materials. They can build the factory, and then they can produce whatever new jet or new rocket or new instrument of death is needed. And this is all done compliments of the taxpayers. The goal of giant global capitalism is the third worldization, not only of the U.S. economy, but of the entire world. I've written books on that. The U.S. global military machine undermines any country, any government, any leader that uses the land, labor, capital, and natural resources for the development of their own country. So we have not only public suppression and impoverishment at home, but we got it around the entire globe, with wars two, three, four at a time, military bases, hundreds of them around the world. The empire feeds off the republic, the face of imperialism, I called it. $1 trillion a year is spent from the Pentagon budget and related budgets, increasing the deficit into trillions upon trillions. I advocate socialism when it works and because it works. The post office, it works. They're trying to bust up the post office, and they're doing a good job of it now, the Republican Congress is. But it was a very decent kind of thing. It was the largest union workers, a group of union workers in any one, I think, any one enterprise. You could deliver, you still can, deliver for 47 cents. You can deliver a letter from your door to someone 3,000 miles away for 45 cents, 47 cents, you can do that. Social Security, we've got, and I like that. I think it's fair, it's humane, it's decent. Medicare, when it works, against a prohibitive, profit-driven medical and insurance corporations. Public health care for everyone and everything. Housing, transportation, as in France, for instance, or Japan, where they've got these tremendous super monorail trains that go that cannot be derailed. I like that. Public utilities, I find that's better than private utilities. I live in California, and I got PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. They talk about private competition, and we're efficient, and we give you. Well, they don't do that at all. They charge us the highest rates in America. If you had a public utility, that public utility doesn't spend millions of dollars on advertising. It doesn't spend millions of dollars on its CEO bosses having to be paid 30, 40, 50 million a year. The public utilities are much, much safer. PG&E got a $45 million handout from the state of California to start checking up on the gas leaks in his whole system of gas And it didn't do it. It even got, in San Bruno, it got complaints from people who were smelling gas, and it didn't do it. It used that money to wage a proposition campaign, to have a proposition which said that only private utilities can function in California, no public utilities. And they had millions of dollars to spend, and the miracle was that they lost. The people voted against that. The people are interested in socialism, as long as you don't call it socialism and you just give them the benefits and the functions of it. And so what PG&E did was they spent all that money on that campaign. They lost the campaign, but in San Bruno there was an explosion, a gas leak, and 8 people were killed and 40 homes were blasted. I saw photographs of it. I treated it in my book, Profit Pathology. A little bit of a chapter on that. And public education is being destroyed, as we see before our own eyes, where students are having to pay for education when they were supposed to get one that was free with minimal costs. Professorships are getting wiped out, and adjuncts are being used. An adjunct is a teacher who gets paid only by a course, one course here, one there, and all that. Very poorly paid, hard to survive. And this is what's happening. And the money goes to the big administrators and goes to the presidents of the universities and the regents and the like. So you turn the university into something that resembles a private corporation. We hear that we must fix the system. Unfair tax distribution, insufficient health care goes on, low wages, wage theft, all sorts of inequities. But no, some of us argue, the system is fixed. It's rigged already. It is the way they want it to work. As far as they're concerned, these last 10 years haven't been so bad. I've had students say, one time when I was teaching at SUNY, State University of New York, in Albany, the students said, But what socialism, how would it work? It's a dream. Isn't it a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice? That's a phrase I myself coined just to sum it up for their anxieties. You think it's a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. My students at SUNY, they would say, how would it work? And I would say, well, you're sitting in it right now. You are too, you know, or less and less, of course, as they privatize it. Better than private colleges on Long Island and more affordable before they raise tuition horribly and privatize private education. And so I'm for that. I'm for real public education. I'm for real public utilities, for public housing that's affordable and made in a humane fashion, public transportation, public hospitals. So I advocate socialism because it works when it works. Small business, small services, maybe they could also work and have a place there. End the power of these giant corporations, bring back real democracy and real prosperity. Thank you for your kind attention, folks.
Michael Parenti, concluding his fine talk, Capitalism versus Reality, very lightly edited by yours truly. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.